Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Ruby Rogues podcast. This is Charles Max Wood, and this week on our panel we have James Edward Gray from Gray Productions. He's been a longtime member of the community, and we're happy to have him here just about every week.
Hey, me too.
And I almost forgot to mention that it's his birthday. He's an old man.
Yay. It's my birthday today, that's right. We recorded an episode.
75 years old there, James?
Yeah, that's pretty close, yes. Just 75.
That's all, just 75. Well, that was Gregory Brown chiming in. Greg is the master over at Ruby Mendicant University. He is also the author and maintainer of the Prawn PDF Library, and does a whole bunch of other stuff for the community, including jumping in the middle of the Ruby Gems debate. So, welcome, Greg. I have to apologize, though. I'm running a little slow. I got back from vacation yesterday, and my brain isn't working at full speed. Also, we have Mike Moore. Mike is a Rubyist here that I actually had lunch with him today, and he's the organizer of the Mountain West Ruby Conference, the Ruby Web Conference, and is the host at the Rubyverse podcast. Welcome, Mike.
Hello.
And last but not least, we also have Peter Cooper, who runs Ruby Inside, and I'm drawing a blank. What else do you do? Ruby Weekly.
Ruby Weekly, JavaScript Weekly, lots of kind of cool stuff. So, hi, boys and girls.
He's your weekly news guy.
That's right. And I'm Charles Max Wood from TeachMeToCode.com, and we'll go ahead and jump in and get started.
So, can I ask a question off of the intros?
Go ahead.
I've never listened to Rubyverse. Mike, what's it about?
Rubyverse is an excuse for me to talk to people, and they talk about different subjects, and then I edit it so they sound extra smart, and that's about it. So it's kind of a no-frill, information-only podcast.
So interviews mainly? Is that what you do?
Interviews, yeah, mainly. Only, gotcha. Actually.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Very cool.
He's interviewed some really cool people. It's definitely worth checking out, rubyverse.com.
Yep, I'll check that out.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this week we're going to be talking about debugging, and I think we're going to get into debuggers a little bit too. It was interesting when we were talking about it before we got started. A lot of people were saying, well, I don't know a whole lot about debuggers, and it sounds like people do most of their debugging in ways other than using an explicit debugger. So I'm a little curious, and I'll just let whoever wants to jump in, but what do you use when you have a bug that you have to track down in your code?
My wife.
That answers it, really, doesn't it?
I use putus.
Putus.
Yeah, printlining, basically.
Yep.
You know, I think a lot of us, you know, at various stages in our careers, and even, you know, where we're at now, you know, where some of us are pretty advanced in our careers, most of you more than I, you know, if you think it's something that you can find pretty easily or quickly, yeah, put S is a really quick and easy way to do it.
No, just use P. I can make you 70% more efficient.
That's right. P. Yay, Peter.
I actually, what I use instead of doing puts or in combination with it is I'll actually use raise quite a bit with just a message, because then it halts the execution.
That's awesome.
That's interesting.
That is, by the way, my favorite way to debug Rails. When I'm in the middle of something and it's down in some action and I want to see what an object is, I just raise and then whatever the object is and call dot inspect on it, so it turns it into a string for the error message, and boom, just reload the page and it pops right up at the top of the page.
So I have a little bit of an issue with that method, and that is just that you kind of have to run things over and over again to get different bits of information. So if you don't pull up the object and see the issue right there, then if you call another raise or put s, I mean, you have to change it and then run it again. I mean, isn't that a little bit slow or inefficient?
Yeah, you're right that it is. So let me ask you this, Chuck. What do you do in the middle of a Rails stack when you want to look something up? What do you do?
I usually actually use the Ruby debug library. You just require it, and then you put debugger in there, and it effectively opens up an interactive prompt, kind of like IRB,
right,
where you can then query the state of your stack at that point.
So, in my experience, I've noticed that there's like two kinds of people in the world, two kinds of programmers that I seem to come across, and it's half of the world does their debugging in a debugger, and that's just how they do it. And they, and whenever they run into a bug, they immediately fire up the debugger, and that's what they tend to do. The other half of the world is like what most of us have mentioned, that they, you know, just a little bit of application of puts, and we tend to track things down that way. And it's always been interesting to me because I've used a debugger in the past. I can use a debugger, and I know how it works. And I've actually tried to hook myself on them a couple of times. I've actually like tried to get into the habit of using them regularly, and I cannot do it. And I think the reason for me, I've been trying to figure that out, and I believe it's that it's a context shift. It's that when I'm sitting there and I'm working on the code and I have it all in my head, then I'm working on the code and I have it in my head. So it makes sense for me to just say, well, it's probably going wrong somewhere right around here. So let me just see what it's printing right around here and then print that out. And I stay in the same context. But when I have to stop and then fire up the debugger and set a breakpoint and get it to step through to the right point, you know, and all that, I had to stop thinking about the problem for a while, and that context shift bothers me.
Yeah, James, that's a really good point. Actually, that's why I actually find using Rails is not really inefficient, especially because when I do my debugging, I try to think through the path somewhat. So I'm not just sort of putting in a put statement or a Rails in a random place and seeing what happens, but trying to think through the path. And then what it does is it allows me to focus on just one thing at a time, because when I drop into a debugger, the explorative nature of being able to interactively interact with objects and things like that gets me distracted. And I find that like what normally happens is I'll do Rails statements and I'll run it, and then based on the outcome of that, I already know where the very next place that I might put it would be. And it just helps me focus on one thing at a time.
That makes sense. I have to say that I don't really see a huge difference between using a debugger like Ruby Debug or Ruby Debug 1.9, depending on, you know, which version of Ruby you're running, versus using put statements, because effectively you just put the debugger, the breakpoint in where you would put your put statement, and then from there you can step through your code to the next place you would put it if you're not seeing an apparent problem there. But effectively what you're doing is you are running a whole bunch of put statements. It's just that you've kind of frozen the context. You don't have to run it over and over.
Right.
But I think that's actually a disadvantage, because you need to keep that whole – you basically need to come up with an execution plan ahead of time for where you're going to put those breakpoints, where if you stop the world, and then what you can do is you can make the decision at that time where the next place to go will be. So I don't really think that there's a whole lot of value looking in five predetermined places when the first answer is going to tell you yes or no, yes or no, yes or no sort of thing.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, you get the first no, this isn't the problem, and you've already got the context set up so that you can immediately move on to the next place, unless it's previous in the execution, because you can always step forward, you just can't step backward.
Right.
So you move on to the next spot if it's further down the execution chain, and you know you get another.
Right. You step sideways when you realize that your first idea was wrong. And I mean, normally when you're looking at a debugging problem, you want to divide up the space,
right?
Rather than going deep, you want to try to figure out whether your initial idea was right or wrong. Well, if your initial idea was right but you didn't get enough context there, a debugger is nice because you can step down, you know, to the next step moving forward. But if your whole idea was wrong, then you have to start over and set up a whole other context.
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't know, Chuck, where are you finding a situation where debugging something is taking all that much time to run it?
Sorry,
go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to answer Greg's question real quick. The places that I found this the most effective, really, is in code that I didn't write and I don't completely understand anyway. And so under that context, it's nice because then I can stop the world and I can say, what is everything doing? And so then I get a feel for the context where it's at, and then I can move through it.
That's where a debugger and pry probably overlap in their value. A couple weeks ago I was saying that I like using pry basically for the exact purpose that you said, because if you are trying to figure out where to go, then having an interactive prompt is very, very useful. So if that's your use case, I definitely agree with that in terms of the general value of it.
Yeah. In general, I don't go directly to the debugger either. I usually actually do start with put statements. But if the solution it doesn't become apparent in a try or two, then I'll plug the debugger in so that I can actually walk through it step by step and see where I'm going wrong.
So I think that's actually a really good point. As far as debugging, I do actually just prefer puts, or as Peter pointed out in Ruby, we have P, which is even better. I have used a debugger in the past to understand an algorithm. Like if it's a tight loop and it's using a couple of variables and it's one of those that it's complicated enough, I can't work it out in my head what's in which variable each time through the loop, and I just want to walk through a few phases of it. I do like a debugger for that, because I can walk through a phase of the loop, examine each variable, and then do it again and again, you know.
So basically, the longer the life cycle of the problem, the more useful a debugger gets to be, because you sort of, especially if you don't understand the code that you're working on, because you can sort of look at it at the intermediate points. And so if there's a long set of intermediate steps, then that makes sense. I think like when we first talked about debugging, we're more thinking, oh, something broke. And if you can isolate that end to end, that's where you don't necessarily need the debugger.
Right. So, go ahead, James.
I think Greg's actually onto something there, too, in that I don't spend a lot of time just randomly bug hunting these days. Like, and I think that's because I'm so good about testing and always doing that. So my cycle is really short, you know, from the time on the amount of code I write before it's actually being run somewhere and I see a problem, you know. And when you only have three lines to look in, you generally know right where the problem is, you know. So I think I've gotten to the point where I just don't spend much time debugging anymore. And when I am kind of planning something out or trying to see how pieces work together, I tend to fire up IRB and you know, play with objects a little bit and until I've got it in my head pretty good. So then, you know, I go back in and write some tests around it and build it. But so I think that's part of the point, is the reason the debugger's not that valuable to me is I've managed to really shorten that cycle between, you know, when I was years ago, I would write 6,000 lines of code and then try to run it, you know, and that's horrible, you know, and at that point, debugger is very helpful.
Right. So totally James, agree. James is just so good that, he's just so good.
James just doesn't write buggy code, period.
That's right. If you just don't make mistakes, you don't need a debugger at all. That's the way to go.
Yeah.
He's right, though.
It is true, and we talk about tests as kind of a way of avoiding bugs, but there's another means or methodology of finding bugs that I was taught that I haven't used a lot, and that is that you write a test that basically exposes the bug. Do you guys do debugging in that way at all, where you know there's a problem, so you write a test that, you know, basically should pass when you fix the bug?
I've had to do that extensively, especially because in open source projects that become so important. I've worked on a lot of things that are very high complexity, and you will have regressions if you don't actually automate the tests for finding the problems. What the process normally is, like, for example, like the best example is Prawn, you know, because PDF generation is crazy hard, and when things break, it's possible that later on they'll break again in not obvious ways. Mm-hmm. So what normally would happen is people would talk, they would basically say, I tried to do this and then my PDF blew up, right? And we would use a combination of messing around in IRB and put statements. And I didn't use Pry at the time, but I definitely would have if I had it available to me. That's a place for a debugger. So you do the sort of exploration process until you feel like you know where the problem is. And then I will typically try to build a minimal example that reproduces the problem. And then once you've got that, if you have just a simple example that really only touches the things that really matter at the core that reproduces the problem, it's so easy to turn that into a test that even if you're not doing TDD day to day, it would be like, it would just be irresponsible not to turn it into a test because then you've got
you know what that's called?
Bug forever. It's
bug-driven development.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is like the more complex something is, the more people who have to use it and work on it, the more that your test should cover every regression. Because by the time you have a bug fixed, it should be so easy to produce that. But I don't know that I would start there as my first step. A lot of times we will fix the bug, you know, in a spike and then back that out and then write the test, get the failure, and then make it pass.
Right.
So bug-driven development, that's BDD?
That's right.
Yeah, baby.
Sorry, just checking.
Well, actually, that was the original idea behind TDD. You know, the original concept before the concept of behavior-driven development was that tests were regression suites. So the whole point of BDD was to tell people, look, it's about more than that. But it still includes that as a core component. The regression suites are really, really valuable.
I got to agree with Greg. I always try to. So, I mean, to me, in any bug hunt, the step one is find the bug, right? And you have to get to the point where it's repeatable. That's the whole point. Once it's repeatable, then it's super easy to fix, right? So if I'm going to do that, I would much rather do that by just being writing the test that narrows it down. But even if I was in untested code for whatever reason, the first thing I would do is I would try to come up with the exact series of steps that led me to the bug every time. And I would probably try to automate that so I could sit there, try something, run it again, try something, run it again, try something, run it again.
Have any of you guys actually worked in QA?
Nope.
I've trained QA people before.
Okay. So I'm the only one here with actual QA experience. And that's exactly what the process is for QA, both in validating new releases and in finding bugs is, yeah, you break it down to an exact process to replicate the bug. Or in the case of acceptance testing, you present an exact case that should produce an exact outcome, and then you verify that the outcome matches. And you know, it's not very different from what we do in our unit and integration tests, but that's exactly it. You break it down into step by step by step that a kindergartner could follow to break your code, or to verify that it actually works.
But that's so helpful. I mean, as a programmer, once I have those steps, I can always figure it out. You know, it's as soon as I've isolated it to the point where it fails every time, it's a few seconds from dead, you know?
And I think that's part of like what you were saying before, even though you're kind of joking about it, about just not having to debug all that often. I think that using regression suites actually reduces the amount of time that you're hunting down old bugs or reintroducing, because once you make a test for something, then if you got that wrong, if you found out that you didn't get to the root of the problem, it will eventually fail when you change something or it'll fail in another way and you add another test. So over time, your more stable parts of your code get better and better guarded against these bugs. And so once you've basically squashed them forever with tests, if they ever reproduce, you just get a really quick feedback loop, and you know that the regression is related to the change that you just made right then and there, and not one that might have been made 6 months ago.
Yeah, and I think honestly that when we think about kind of the hairiest or most painful debugging experiences we have, it's usually not the ones where we ran the test suite and it said, oh, by the way, this is broken. It's usually the other way around, where it wasn't covered by the test suite. And by putting those tests in, you protect against that kind of behavior in the future.
Right.
I, I have another question that I want to get into, and this is kind of related to debugging, but it kind of grows out of something that Greg said. He was talking about how, and he was riffing off of what James said about complicated loops and things that you can't, you know, hold it all into your head or you know, figure out exactly what it's doing, you know, over the course of its execution. And so I'm wondering if the need for a debugger indicates some sort of deficiency in your code cleanliness or clarity.
That's an interesting question. It definitely, so I'm trying to think about when I've needed that. And it's been in situations where if I simply printed out the intermediate results of some complicated process, it would be overwhelming or not especially meaningful to look at that output. So what I wanted to do is grab a hold of that object and interrogate it with some interactive calls and play around with it and all of that sort of stuff. But that sort of means that there's some amorphous blob sitting in the middle of what's a complicated process. And it could be an indication that, you know, there's a lot of dependencies that are tied up with one another, or that the flow has an intermediate step knowing way more about the process than it should have to, and that sort of thing. And I find that, like, for example, if you go into that and you break down the problem more and you, say, take something that used to be a class with 200 methods and make it composed of some other objects, that, like, the more that you can do to isolate things, then the easier it gets to be to have a low ceremony debugging process. So I think that it's interesting to think of, is that a metric that there's a sign of a problem? Is it a code smell, so to speak? I think maybe so.
Uh-huh. Well, it also makes it easier to test. So, I mean, you know, there are both sides of that coin, and they may be related as well, where, you know, you have the, I have to use a debugger because this is so complicated that I can't keep track of it on my own with simple puts statements. But at the same time, you know, testing long or complicated methods can be, you know, it can be kind of hairy as well, where if you've tested all the underlying pieces, then testing the overarching functionality isn't necessarily as tricky.
I think that situation can kind of arise naturally too, even if you are, you know, doing pretty good composition of breaking things apart. And that, like, if you have, you know, two or three processes, for example, that are interacting with each other, you know, it can get pretty complicated pretty fast. And I've run into scenarios there where it's very difficult using just some print statements to figure out what's going on. Unfortunately, if it really is a bunch of processes, then something like Ruby Debug generally isn't all that much more helpful to me anyway. You know, it doesn't, yeah, you know, easily allow me to grab all three and peek inside at the same time at the exact same thing, you know.
Yeah, so at that point, you sort of need an integration testing harness that'll deal with, like, looking at it from the whole picture.
Right. Yeah. That would be interesting. I'm a little curious as to what that would look like.
Yeah. I tend to use a shared log file and have everybody start writing to the log, you know, so that I can see, you know, with each process identifying its process ID and the thing. So, you know, there again, I'm just using a more elaborate form of a put statement, you know, and that I'm throwing them in the log just so I can see what each one is thinking, you know, at the same time.
All right. I have one more question that I want to jump in on, and then, you know, maybe we can change tactics a little bit. Have any of you guys used the debuggers that are built into the IDEs, and do you find them more of a useful tool or more of a distraction?
I've never used an IDE for Ruby ever.
Don't bother.
I think they're a lot more popular in languages like Java and stuff, where the language is so static that the IDE can make a ridiculous amount of assumptions. and thus do a lot of things for you. You know, you can say, you know, all the refactorings and stuff like that that languages like that have, because they're very static and you can always count on them, you know. And in Ruby, where everything is so dynamic, you know, that it's basically impossible for the IDEs to know exactly what they're looking at, I think that lowers the appeal a lot. And I don't know, there again, it seems like there's kind of two levels of programmers. There's the level where, you know, they want to have as much as possible done for them, and then the ones where, you know, they really want to just be in control of everything. So I guess this is me saying I'm an egomaniac, and I just really need that level of control. So, yeah, for me, it's just a text editor.
Happy birthday, egomaniac.
Right, yeah, exactly.
All right, so... No, go ahead.
So I used to be a .NET developer, and I used to spend an awful lot of time in Visual Studio. And we used the debug a lot in that environment. I think the difference between Ruby and an environment like Java or like the .NET world is just the amount of complexity in the environment and in that culture. And the debugger is useful because that's really the only way to discover not really, you know, what the problem is that you're having, but just how the system works, right? Because you can't go and just look at the source code. You can't, you know, gem open and go through your different libraries. You've actually got to place a breakpoint and inspect all the different actors that are going on in your system at runtime to try and get an idea about what the system is actually trying to do or how the system is trying to accomplish the task at hand. And so it's more of a, I agree, it is probably a philosophical approach to, you know, how you code and how you organize all of your different concerns and, you know, solidify it to instructions that are getting saved into a file somewhere. But I also think that there's just something to be said about these big giant companies trying to push out a solution that's going to solve everybody's needs and the overwhelming complexity that comes with that.
Have right? you tried, I mean, Ruby and Steel?
I played with it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, like the debugger in that. I mean, I have to try all of these things just for the fact that I end up writing about them. So I only played with it a bit. But yeah, it's basically like a Visual Studio. It uses Visual Studio. It's IDE for Ruby on Windows. Really good work. It's like one guy working on it, and he's done a crazy job on it. But the debugger in it, I think, was like written from scratch, so it's not using any of the existing stuff. And it has, like, in Visual Studio, you get conditional breakpoints. So you can, like, put in, you know, a condition that you want to be true, like literally, like x equals equals 10. And literally at any point in the program where there's a local variable called x and it equals 10, it will stop. You know, you can change variables on the fly when you're, you know, you're at breakpoints and everything. It's just really crazy. But I'm not using Windows and I'm not using Visual Studio. But if I were, it's just a really slick implementation. And I imagine it's a lot like what is on Visual Studio for .NET developers, but I've never done any .NET development. So I'm imagining it's a similar situation in that area, though.
Yeah, like we never really used the debugger in Visual Studio to debug our code. Not nearly as much as we did just to try and figure out, you know, what the hell system.windows.forms is doing, right? Because it's just, it's so opaque, you just can't see through it, right?
Right. When is this chunk of code being called? When is, you know, when does this change to this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, and after like the, you know, the 300th page of MSDN documentation, you start to not remember what you're reading anymore. And, you know, just going straight to the sources or straight to the behavior within the debugger is a lot easier way to learn.
So I got a couple of things out of there. Mike mentioned gem open, which actually my particular technique is gem unpack. I'm not sure if that's similar, where it just throws the source code into a folder that I can crack open and go look at exactly what Ruby's doing. And I really love that. That kind of made me think, maybe we could go around the horn. Anybody have any other great tips for debugging? Because I have a couple I think I could give that may be helpful.
Why don't you start first?
Okay. In Ruby, especially if you have threads going and a thread dies with an exception, the default behavior is to just carry on. And it's not until you do something like join that thread where you'll get the exception. And I've seen multiple people just totally mystified by this behavior because their program actually had some problem way back when, but then they find out about it later. And on Ruby's thread class, there's a method called abort on exception equal. And if you call abort on exception equal and pass true, then the minute any thread has an exception, the entire Ruby interpreter will just die with the stack trace. And that's like super helpful for debugging thread exceptions. Then other things that are cool to know about, Ruby has a debug flag. It's dash D that you pass to the interpreter. And it sets a global variable. So it's $DEBUG in all caps to true whenever you use that flag. And this causes Ruby to have a lot more error spitting behavior, which is great. And you get a lot more feedback from things that happen. But you can also use it yourself, right? So you can just write statements in Ruby and say, like, puts such and such if $DEBUG, you know, and then that way, when you want to trigger those statements, you can just start Ruby with the dash D. And when you don't want to trigger those statements, you cannot start Ruby with the dash D. So I kind of like that mechanism for debugging prints when I want to put some in. I'm working with something. It sometimes doesn't work well if you're using a lot of other libraries or stuff because they tend to be so chatty in their warning behavior that it drowns out the other stuff. But if it's just a simple program yourself you're using, it's pretty good technique. Some other things, we've already mentioned puts, and of course P, which is Ruby's debugging print that prints now more like Ruby sees the object. Other things that are nice, if you have YAML loaded, YAML makes a Y method. It's literally just the letter Y. And that will print it out as a YAML document, basically, which is sometimes helpful for more complex objects with a bunch of fields. So you can use that as another form of a debugging print. And I know there's libraries out now that do really cool stuff like Awesome Print and stuff. I don't tend to use those. I actually had somebody ask me the other day, we were looking in an IRB session. He said, do you have Awesome Print? You could just turn that on. It would show us the names of these objects. And I said, sure, I have Awesome Print. And I did .map:\name, you know, so I could see the names of the objects, you know. And I think it's back to the context shifting. I prefer to use my programming to show me what I want to see. But if you do like those automatic, you know, shows you more information, you might look at something like Awesome Print. And then one other tip, just that I've thought of in the time we were having this conversation in Rails, there's a method in the views, a helper method called debug, and you can pass it an object, and this time it's little debug, but you can pass it an object, and it basically turns it into YAML, sticks it in pre-tags, and then drops it in your page right there. So that can be useful for seeing what's going on inside of Rails. It'll ugly up your page really bad, but you'll be able to see what's going on. So those are just some of the many debugging tips I can think of that I've used before.
Wow. That was awesome.
So I'm saving them up.
I've got a couple. One is, and this I don't use very often at all, but I found it useful or at least interesting when I do use it. Is that pretty much object freeze is useful or useless for pretty much everything, except that if you freeze an object that you expect not to change and then pass it through a path where it's not supposed to change and then something tries to change it, it'll blow up on you. So if you've got like some object that's being passed around that's being modified when it's not supposed to be, like maybe there's an array that has a dangling reference somewhere that's being changed or something like that, if you freeze the object, then it'll get you to the exact line where the modification was attempted.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's a really good trip, and it made me think of one more that I've seen. If you're using a API like RexML, you know, some kind of XML parsers, pull API where it reads and then calls methods as events happen or something like that. Basically, any evented API. Sometimes, if you want to figure out what exactly is going on, you can pass just a nothing object with method missing defined that just does a puts whenever it's called and shows what arguments it got and stuff like that. So you can see which methods are being called with which arguments, and that shows you exactly the interface you need to implement. But yeah, Greg's trick of using freeze is very helpful in those scenarios too.
So another one that I don't use often but is still interesting, I think, is that if you require YAML, you get a Y method. And Y pretty much works like P, but it makes the output in YAML. And again, that's not especially useful. Like, I wouldn't use it as a replacement for like PP or something like that. But what it does do, which is interesting, is because of the way that YAML works, is it'll make references to the same object look very explicit. So if you think that you're dealing with a bunch of copies of objects, but you're actually dealing with references to the same object, it's sometimes a lot clearer to look at it through the YAML output than it is through any other inspect format that I've seen.
That sounds useful too. I think James mentioned that. I'm taking notes, but I didn't write who said what. One other trick that I think James kind of mentioned in reverse that I would bring up is that you can create a logger. And I've done this before where I just needed, specific output from a specific process. And so what I would do is instead of putting a whole bunch of put S's in there, I would just put a logger. And so I'd create a logger, I'd have it log to its own file, and then I would just have it dump a whole bunch of information out to it and then dig through it that way. And James also mentioned, pulling in where you have everything logging to the same place. And that's also useful in a lot of cases where you have multiple threads or processes working in the same ways, or working on the same data.
So James, when you use that approach, do you do something to make sure that the logs like indicate which process is which?
Yeah, I try to pretty much always do that. In fact, that's the one thing that bugs me about Rails Logger is it doesn't by default include the process ID, and I always will do that. If I set up the log, I will make sure that as part of that information at the beginning of the line that the process ID is in there so I can tell exactly which program did what,
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I never really thought about it, but it makes sense.
It's really helpful. I got to give one other tip for debugging because I've only learned this one recently and it's like a whole new world for me. So this is my best recommendation. And I actually saw it tweeted. This is ironic because I saw it tweeted just the other day and I made sure to retweet it. But seriously, do not debug alone. You don't have to. And you will not believe what a difference that makes. I've recently been working on a project where there's another developer available to me, and I can't believe how when I run into a problem, if I go get that other developer and ask for help, I think it's hard because by default we think it kind of makes us feel bad, like, oh, can I bug you for a second, but it's like whenever I try to debug it on my own, it's like, 45 minutes or whatever, I'm sitting there doing it. And whenever I ask for that help, I swear within 10 minutes, we both have it. And it's just the fact that, two minds really are better than one. It's whatever you miss, the other guy will see. Whatever you didn't think of, he will, and man, it makes all the difference in the world. So open invitation. If you're stuck and you're fighting a bug, just call me on Skype. I'll be your wingman.
Sounds good.
That's a really good point, James. I think part of it is that whenever a bug happens, it's basically impossible, at least for me, not to already have a path in mind that I want to go down. So I might miss some obvious things on the surface that weren't on that path that someone else just looking at the screen could see.
Yeah, one other thing I want to add to that is that a lot of times if I've written the code, then I have certain expectations that certain parts of it already work. And if I have somebody else come in, then they don't have those same assumptions. And a lot of times they'll take you in a different direction.
Exactly. It's, you know, a lot of times you're like, I just know it's over here. But the other guy, he doesn't have those assumptions, right? And he's like, no, it's probably that other method you wrote that's crap, you know, and, uh-huh. and he'll say that, you know, and he'll force you to prove it. And maybe it's not true. You know, maybe that's not really the thing. But, you know, it's the fact that he forces you to prove that, you know, that he doesn't have those preconceived notions. And I got to stress that whenever I debug with someone else, every time I'm amazed at how quickly we get straight to the heart of the problem. So stop debugging alone. That's my advice.
So this is a bit of a tangent, but just because you mentioned the word proof, I actually use little informal proofs all the time when I think that some assumption of mine about a system should be true, but I know that if I just assume it, that it could cause problems for me. So I'll a lot of times write up little examples or mess around in IRB to test the concept rather than just trusting my intuition, because if it works out the way that I expect it to, it's good because I can sort of assume it's going to be true, which reduces the solution space. If it's wrong, then I have to completely rethink things. So sometimes I'll attack a bug by checking my assumptions without even necessarily directly working on the bug itself.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those proofs that you're talking about make really good tests.
Right. They certainly sometimes, so it depends on whether they test anything of value, because sometimes what they are just exploratory sort of things. But in the end, for the most part, if there's some behavior that you're trying to verify and you don't have a test for it, it does, the structure of that naturally translates to a test, without a doubt. There's just a question of sometimes those are like not really describing a behavior. They're just exploring some part of the process, and that doesn't necessarily need to become part of your test suite.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I want to ask another question. Once you've found a bug, and I know that this is pretty specific to the problems that you might run into or the bug that you may find, but what's your process once you've found a bug for actually fixing it or solving the problem? I mean, at that point, do you write a test first and then solve it, or do you just go in and change it and see if that makes the difference, or?
I mentioned, for me, I normally will try to spike and see if I can make a difference, make it fixed, and then I rerun through the manual test process. And then once I've confirmed that, I'll normally stash my changes, add a test, and then reinstate them to see if the test passes.
Okay. Ooh, cool use of stash. I like it.
All right. Anyone else? Is that how everyone else does it?
Yeah, I think finding a bug for me is usually building the test. So at that point, I already have it, and then I feel free to go in there and just start hammering away at fixing it, because if I break something else, then hopefully my test will show me that, right?
Yep.
So, James, let me ask you this. Do you find sometimes that you're writing tests? The reason why I don't normally start with tests is because a lot of times I'll write a test, but it's at too high of a level, and then I write another test, and then I write another test. So I get a reproduction, but it's not really the minimal reproduction. And then I get a test that is valuable as a validation, but doesn't necessarily describe a behavior, and it doesn't describe the bug at a low enough level to be a sufficient fix. So do you find yourself sometimes writing too many tests that way?
That's a good point in that I do tend to guess what level it's at, and you're totally right that I guess wrong fairly often. You know, that's got to be in the controller, you know, and you go write a test around that controller action and you find it. But then as you dig, you're like, oh, no, actually it was down in this model method. And when that happens to me, I actually this isn't the most efficient way, so I'm not offering a great solution, but when that happens to me, I do just go rip the test out of my controller and I rewrite it as a model test when I've moved it down. So I kind of hone in on it, but you're right that I'm kind of wasting some effort there. So
yeah, that was what I was curious about, because I mean, it may, if you're guessing reasonably well, it might not be terribly inefficient to do it that way. But the tests left over, the ones that weren't at the right level, I've actually found those because I used to just leave them in when I tried to do testing that way. And then I found that those would make for brittle tests because they'd be testing something that like exposes a problem but isn't quite at the right level, so they don't fully solve the problem. And they also aren't, like, if you get a failure from one of those tests, it's not necessarily a sign of a problem later, moving on. So it's just good to hear that you removed them, because that's always the thing that I wrestled with and caused me to avoid writing them.
Yeah, I think that's actually kind of an interesting point, because I think people have taboos about removing tests. If a test is useless for any reason, because things have changed or my understanding has changed or whatever, I don't have any problem removing a test. I would rather have the right amount of tests covering what I want to cover than you know, some ability to brag that, oh, look, I wrote 10 times the amount of tests I did as normal code. That's
but it's
not
my baby.
It's my baby, right. Yeah, it's not important to me. I'm a baby killer.
No! You heard it here first.
That's right.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and make the call. We're gonna move on to our picks, you know, so that we can honor that time contract that I always bring up when I end the conversation. So if you're new to the podcast, the picks are basically just things that we find that we like. Usually most of them are code-related that, you know, make our jobs or lives easier, but, you know, we do bring in other things as well, just, you know, whatever we're into at the time. So I'm going to go ahead and we'll let the birthday boy go first. James, I know one of your picks is birthday cake, right?
Birthday cake. Yeah, who doesn't love birthday cake? My favorite's angel food. So the pick I'm going to make today for my birthday, my wife took me out to the game store and let me just basically pick out whatever I want. Actually, the Ruby community's been kind of getting into games, I've noticed. If you go to the conferences and stuff, there's usually some kind of side events going on with gaming. And I totally encourage you to get into that if you haven't yet. Try a few out. But for those who don't know, there's this massive world of games out there. Board games we're talking about here, card games, that kind of thing, that does not mean Monopoly and Scrabble. So if that's your idea of a board game, you have no idea what you're talking about, and you're really missing this cool world that is out there. Lots of Euro games. The best ones tend to come from Europe. So I'm going to recommend that everybody who's not yet check out all the cool games that are out there. If you just want something great to play with your wife or a friend, then try something like Lost Cities or Jumbo. If you want a great group game that you will have a total blast, that's fairly easy to teach anybody and it's a lot of fun, try Pandemic, which is actually a cooperative game. So you're all on the same side against the board, which is trying to destroy you. It's a very fun game. Everybody loves it. And then if you just want to go crazy, then you can try games like Agricola or Race for the Galaxy, things like that. But all great games. So if you haven't checked out the world of gaming lately, you need to try that out. You're missing something.
Wow. I haven't heard of any of those. Now I feel ashamed.
Well, see, I gave you a great pick.
Yeah, well, my wife and I are way into board games, and you know, we've played several of the ones that come out of Europe, just none of these. So
what ones do you play, Chuck?
We really got into Catan a while ago.
That's a good game.
We also got into Ticket to Ride. I'm trying to think. You put me on the spot and I don't remember. But
Ticket to Ride is very good as well. Those are both good and a little bit casual and a little bit gateway. So you can go farther. Keep going. You're getting there.
Oh, you're going to ruin my life. All right, Peter, go ahead.
Okay. First, I'm just going to tell James that the cake is a lie. That's important to know. And I guess I'm kind of like, I'll just kind of just do a very quick anti pick, which is that Scrabble is an amazing game. It's a very good game, and it is probably the only board game I've played that I actually like and will consistently play. So just different strokes for different folks, I guess. I'm just a big Scrabble fan. So to hear it being dismissed so callously just rankles my, yeah, there you go. I'll just start picking out loads of cool words now.
Actually, that's hilarious, because the one normal board game that everybody plays that I do still play all the time is Scrabble. So I was unfair in dismissing it.
So yay for Scrabble. Yeah, and I used to like Monopoly, but my wife is quite good at it, and she is very relentless. She's a different person when she plays it, and she will like take me to the cleaners. So I've kind of gone off Monopoly since marrying her. So moving on to slightly more technical things, though, I also want to start this kind of like Attack James Day. I kind of want to stand up for Michael Dvorkin and Awesome Print, because Awesome Print really is awesome. I really do love it, and there's lots of cool stuff in there. Like you can do, you know, just AP, and then like you can use an active record class, and bam, it will show you all the attributes. And you know, it will kind of just use magic in a lot of cases to work out what it is you want to see about something, and not necessarily what you know, you are technically trying to represent. So it's just lots of cool stuff in there, worth checking out. Awesome Print. And along similar lines, because we were talking about Rails a little bit, there's something called Rails Footnotes, and I've not used this, but I've seen so many people raving about it on Twitter that I thought I just had to mention it. It puts like a bar at the bottom of your browser, and you can define what stuff you want to appear in there, and that can include debug information and session information, stuff like that. So that could be useful if you are doing sort of more light, higher level debugging in a Rails app. So people just keep recommending it to me, and I've just been too lazy to try it, but I might as well pass that on. And last but not least, I've been just kind of like casually keeping an eye on the Go programming language over the last year or so. I think it came out like 2 years ago now. So just sort of having a casual eye on it. And there was an article out recently called The Go Programming Language, or Why All C-Lite Languages Except One Suck. And basically it's quite a long kind of introduction to why Go is cool compared to, you know, say C, C++, C#, and, you know, just what it brings to the table. And it just sums up Go so well, and why, you know, perhaps you should give it a go. And Go is a cool language. I think we're going to see a lot more systems programming being done in it over the sort of the next 5 to 10 years time frame. It's still a baby, so a good way of getting into it. And I'll be sending the link across so you can put that in the show notes. So that's me.
Awesome. Hey, sounds interesting to me too. All right, I'll go ahead and go next. While I was traveling to Disneyland with my kids, there were a couple of things that really paid off for me. One was that the Android app or the Android App Store had an app that gave us all the wait times and fast pass times for Disneyland while we were there. So I literally would just pull out my phone, turn it on, and unlock it. And I could see what the wait times were, and then, you know, I could take my kids to the lines that wouldn't kill them off because they're 4 and 5 to wait in. And it was really, really super nice. And so I'll put a link to that in the show notes if I can find one. Otherwise, I'll just put the name of the app in because I don't remember what it is. One other pick that I have is my sister turned me on to a book called Elantris by Brandon Sanderson. The copy she had been my brother's before she got her hands on it, and it was pretty well abused and worn out. And so I started reading it. I actually bought it on the Kindle app store, or the Kindle store on my iPad app, and it's a really fun book. I'm really enjoying it. So I guess my picks are just, you know, a game and an Android app, but, you know, That's what I did the last week, so.
At least you didn't say everything James said is bad.
Well, I didn't have to. Peter already said that.
Right, thanks. I'm not showing up for another podcast on my next birthday.
All right, by then, hopefully, your count of episodes and my count of episodes will be the same again, because you've been on more than I have now. All right, Gregory Brown. What do you have to pick this week?
Well, the first thing is my wife and I decided we wanted to stop being couch potatoes and get some exercise. And this is something that I've already seen a lot of Ruby programmers do, but we've been doing the Couch to 5K program. And basically, the idea is that, like, in a period of 9 weeks, you can go from a completely sedentary lifestyle to being able to run a 5K. I don't know that that's realistic, but we've been doing it for 3 weeks now, and it sure works, because it starts off by just incrementally trading walking and running, so you get more running and less walking over time. And for someone who is very, very bad about being consistent or determined about exercise, the program has worked for me, and it's actually fun. And there's all sorts of, you can get apps for it for Android or iPhone or whatever. We've been using, you can also get like MP3s that are set to music that do the timings for you, which are nice. So I would recommend the Couch to 5K program for anyone who wants to get into exercise in a really gradual way. I mean, I'm in hideous shape in terms of my physical fitness, and it's really helped a lot in just a couple weeks. So the other thing, and I swear that Peter hasn't given me a check for this, at least just not yet, is I'd like to recommend RubyFlow, which is it's a site that Peter runs where basically, I don't know how to describe it except for that it's like, it's meant to serve some of the same purposes of what you would use, you know, Reddit, Ruby, or Hacker News for, but it's a totally different thing because there's not voting associated with it. You basically just get a little blob of HTML where you can put a paragraph and a link, and then that gets put there like with everybody else's stuff from that day. And I've found that during the whole Ruby Gems fiasco, that I've been trying to get information out to people about that. And, you know, I did this stuff on my personal blog, which now has a reasonable audience, but didn't before. And that was a way to reach people. And it was also a way just to sort of get information out there without it being yet another point for conversations. So I think that it did drive people over to the blog. I mean, there's a comment system on RubyFlow, but it seems more like it's used for posts than it is for comments, and it's a cool site. In fact, I like it so much that we're stealing his idea, and we're gonna have something like that, a more curated list for the students at RMU. We're building a system inspired by RubyFlow, so the students at RMU can share what they're interested in. But just the mechanics of it are neat, and I wish it was more used than it is, even though it has surprisingly good traffic. So he didn't pay me for that endorsement, but maybe you should.
Yeah, you get $5 off the show.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one, Greg. When I was getting started with blogging and things, it was a great way to build traffic to my site and as well to look and see what was going on and figure out what people wanted to hear about. So, you know, it is definitely a great way to get your message out there, and as well to interact with other Rubyists who are out there, you know, sharing what they have to share as well. So last but not least, we have Mike Moore. Mike, what picks do you have for us?
All right. So I want to give another plug for the Open Gem. It's a plugin for Ruby Gems. And so you install it with gem install open underscore gem. And then you can call gem open underscore gem, and it will open the gem in your editor. And it's not going to make a copy like Unpack will. It's actually going to give you all the files that are on your file system that Ruby is using to run that library. And so you can actually edit it right then and there. So if you need to debug an external dependency, you can just open up the gem as it sits in your system and edit it. And it's a really great little tool.
Sounds good. Sounds pretty handy.
So when I'm doing that, and I don't want to edit a gem on the system because I'm like scared of that,
then don't save.
Then don't save. Yeah, that's a good point. But then you have to run it, right? So you have to save to run it, right?
Yeah.
I when I'm doing that, I just use Ruby's monkey patching. So I just like grab the method and I copy it out of the gem that I unpacked and drop it in whatever file I'm messing with right then, and I edit the hell out of it. And then when I'm all done, I just delete it.
Yeah, I like OpenGem because it it's a little bit easier for me to read different source code in my editor than it is to use something like GitHub's file viewer and stuff like that. So I'm just more comfortable reading code in my own environment instead of on a web page. And so I just like it. So since I've found it, I end up reading a lot more source code. So it's part of that whole kind of initiative that folks were talking about a year or so ago about just reading source code. And I found the OpenGem plugin to be a really handy little tool for doing that.
It is a cool idea. I've seen lots of people do it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about it too. So, was there anything else, Mike?
No, that's it.
All right.
Mike was the quiet member of this show, but the entire time in the back channel, he was telling us what to talk about. So this episode brought to you by Mike Moore.
That's actually what I do on my Rubyverse podcast. So,
yeah, well, that's what makes a good interview. All right, we're going to wrap this up then. I want to thank, in no particular order, Mike Moore, James Edward Gray, Gregory Brown, Peter Cooper, and I'm Charles Max Wood. Thanks, you guys, for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you.
There are a couple of things I want to point out. First off, if you go to rubyrogues.com, you can get the show notes. Also, there's a new link at the top. It says request a topic. We're using user voice for that. I'm not completely fond of the interface, but you can vote for existing topics that other people have suggested, or you can suggest your own. And I appreciate both of those. And that gives us an idea of what you want to hear about so that we can talk about stuff that's relevant to you. The other thing is go ahead and leave comments on the post so that we can, see if there's anything to add. I think this particular discussion, I think there are probably other tricks that we don't know about or have missed. And so if you have other debugging tips, go ahead and leave those in the comments. And finally, leave us a review in iTunes. We really appreciate the feedback that we get there in iTunes. You can rate it. You can write a review. Writing a review helps us out a little bit more. And it only takes a couple minutes. So by all means, do that. And we will catch you next week.
Bye-bye.